From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
So it was not feasible. And eventually, like all bubbles in our capitalistic system, it exploded.
The financial storm facing Puerto Rico. Today, a special collaboration with WNYC in New York.
You know, me coming in with fresh eyes and sitting down very coldly and looking at the numbers said, this ain't working.
As Puerto Rico recovers from the damage dealt by Hurricane Maria, a greater challenge looms, fixing its broken economy.
I've been this close to say, to the hell of it and leave the island.
We do a deep dive into the Puerto Rican debt crisis. That's coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No te vayas. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and I'm joined in the studio by Jane Sassine. Hey, Jane.
Hey, Maria. It's great to be here.
All right. So tell us a little bit about who you are.
So I'm Jane Sassine, and I've been a financial journalist for about 30 years, and I currently run the McGraw Center for Business Journalism at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism.
So, Jane, it's the first time that we're working together, even though we've been, you know, colleagues for about 30 years. And we are all part of a collaboration with New York Public Radio that is looking into Puerto Rico and specifically the debt crisis in Puerto Rico. And, you know, you're a heavyweight financial journalist. You've been doing this for a long time. So what stood out for you as you jumped into the story about Puerto Rico?
Well, you know, I think the person who put it, how can I say it, put it most colorfully was Dick Ravitch.
My name is Dick Ravitch.
If you remember back in the 70s when New York City ran into its own financial troubles, Dick Ravitch was one of the people who stepped in and essentially is credited, along with others, with helping save New York City financially.
I did all the negotiations with the unions and the banks.
So he has, since the 70s, been kind of a leading figure and a guru of what, you know, dealing with municipal bankruptcies. He's advised many of the other cities and whatnot that have gone bankrupt.
I was an advisor to the bankruptcy judge in Detroit.
So he gets involved with Puerto Rico?
Yes. So when Puerto Rico started to run into financial trouble, he had relationships there, and he started talking with them and advising them and started looking at the numbers, and he was seeing things that were very similar to what he had seen in New York and in Detroit.
I saw an amount of debt that could not possibly be serviced by the then current revenues.
He saw something that was, in fact, bigger than New York and bigger than Detroit. You know, much, much bigger, in fact.
And he uses some adult language to describe it.
If you were writing fiction about how a government could f itself up totally in every respect, you couldn't do it more imaginatively than what's happened here.
It's absolutely true. I don't think in 30 years as a financial reporter, I've ever seen a situation quite like this one.
Now, you might be wondering why, given all of the stories in Puerto Rico, the recovery from the hurricane, the fact that the dead are still being counted, the broken electric grid, the fact that there are people who don't even have roofs over their head, why are we talking about the debt now? And the reason is that when you look at the long-term situation for Puerto Rico, the fact that thousands of people are leaving for the mainland, that businesses are closing on the island, it's about something bigger than the hurricane. Because you can fix the electrical grid, you can even fix your roof. But how do you fix an entire economic system? Today on our show, a collaboration with WNYC in New York, we're going to unpack the financial storm affecting Puerto Rico and its future. Okay, Jane, so where are we going to start?
Why don't we start with a man that I met named Elias Gutierrez?
My name is Elias Gutierrez. And I have been a professor at the University of Puerto Rico's Graduate School of Planning since 1965.
Professor Gutierrez is a very sweet man. He's about 76 years old. He's a fairly conservative, particularly within, you know, Puerto Rican economists. And he had been writing for years and years and warning people that the economics of the island were headed for trouble.
We were going to generate a monster, and we did. I call it Jabba the Hutt.
And that monster was the debt.
It was so clear, even then, it was not going to be possible to dominate the monster that we had created.
And Elias, he explained to me how that debt monster was created from the beginning. Puerto Rico, if you recall, has been a U.S. territory since 1898.
The timeless surf pounds this Caribbean shoreline of what Christopher Columbus dubbed El Puerto Rico.
And over the years, the U.S. Congress passed various tax benefits to encourage American manufacturers to come and to produce things in Puerto Rico.
Industrial incentives, including 10-year tax exemption and other tax freedoms, have attracted some 325 plants to the Commonwealth since 1948.
So for a long period, Puerto Rico's economy grew, and it became more dependent on those manufacturing companies.
And today, Puerto Rico is an integral part of the American economic system, a new frontier for business enterprise.
And those tax benefits continued. And more recently, there was a specific tax benefit that drew a lot of American pharmaceutical manufacturers to the island during the 1980s and the 1990s.
7 of the 10 best-selling pharmaceutical products are produced in Puerto Rico.
It was a big part of their economy.
Attractive tax incentives.
So the economy grew and grew.
Mi mayonesa, Hellman's.
Corona, con el cuerpo y el sabor de la mejor cerveza.
Te esperamos en Toys R Us.
The thing is that this productive sector was based on certain special treatments.
But then in 1996, Congress debated taking away those tax benefits. And Elias Gutierrez...
I made a study.
He wrote a paper around that time.
On the direct and indirect effects on the rest of the economy.
About how taking away these tax breaks could impact Puerto Rico, saying, essentially, this is crazy.
They were all negative. It was so clear.
This is, you know, a quarter of our economy and many of our better paying jobs. So what happened is the tax break went away. There was a 10-year phase out. And that was the beginning of Puerto Rico's really, you know, bad economic problems. They lost enormous amounts of jobs and a lot of the manufacturers left.
We lost our attractiveness and we lost our edge.
The economy started to go into recession. And so what often happens when there's a recession is people lose their jobs and they need benefits, so government spending has to go up. But then to make matters worse, the Puerto Rican government was also borrowing money just to pay for the daily expenses of running the government. So that spending kept going up and up, and the economy wasn't growing anymore.
We generated a government or public sector that was just impossible to be financed. And that's when the crisis just took over.
So the analogy I like to make is if you had a credit card and you maxed out that credit card, so you took out another credit card and it was a slightly higher interest rate, but it gave you the money to pay back your first credit card. And then when you maxed that one out, you got another one. And that's what Puerto Rico essentially did. They just kept on borrowing more and more money. It was like they kept on taking out new credit cards.
So it was not feasible. And eventually, like all bubbles in our capitalistic system, it exploded.
And so Elias kept arguing that, you know, this is all going to be very, very bad for the economy. But nevertheless, when he went to invest some of his own money, and this was money he'd saved and was planning for his retirement.
I built a portfolio composed of bonds sold by the Puerto Rican government.
The government sold these bonds to raise money to help pay off the debt and also to continue to fund its activities. And they had a huge market for them. They sold them to individuals and to mutual funds run by Wall Street, a lot of them being sold to Americans in the mainland, really whoever would buy them. And the analogy I was using before, the bonds were like the credit cards, and like each new issue of bonds was like the next credit card. And everybody was saying, these are great. They're good for Puerto Rico. You're helping your country.
Government went out of its way to convince the middle class that it was safe to lend their savings to government.
So he, despite knowing that the economy had problems and despite writing about this professionally, he went ahead and put his own money into bonds. A bunch of his own savings, his retirement money, went into the bonds. And, you know, he talked about how
my broker said that was good because it was balanced.
You know, they were good and they were safe and whatnot.
And it was this and it was that and they were insured. And I believed. And my mind as an economist told me, this is not going to work. But I still believed it.
Why? Knowing all you knew.
I don't know.
So at the same time that the banks and the mutual funds and individuals like Elias are buying bonds and lending all this money to Puerto Rico, in 2012, in New York, there was a woman named Kate Long, who at the time was a reporter for Reuters, and she covered the municipal bond market.
So it's really hard to come up with a subject every day.
She was writing a column for Reuters, and she would just pick different issues to look at. She'd never looked at Puerto Rico before.
And I just happened to pick up the bond documents for a deal they were doing right then, and sat down and read them. It's a couple hundred pages of financial data.
She looked at it. And she looked at the numbers, and she couldn't believe what she saw.
I read it, and I said, these people are going to default.
And ended up writing, it was just a short little piece for Reuters that essentially said, Puerto Rico is going to be America's Greece.
Greece has already defaulted on more than $100 billion of public debt.
Greece can't pay its bills.
The Greek tragedy continues.
And if you recall, this was around when Greece, they had so much debt that they had defaulted on their debt and couldn't pay it. And there was a huge period where, you know, it was causing all sorts of trouble in Europe.
And really innocently, I just wrote that in a column and just said, you know, they're overspending. They can't get their expenses in line with their revenues. Their pension systems are very underfunded. They have a very difficult time collecting taxes.
So she writes this article that's kind of this bombshell, because up until then, all the Wall Street analysts who were following this and the credit ratings agencies said, you know, these bonds are fine. They're good. So the report came out and she was heavily criticized and it started this huge debate. I mean, it was a shock. Nobody had said anything like that before.
You know, me coming in with fresh eyes and sitting down very coldly and looking at the numbers said, this ain't working. And I didn't know any of the people. So no one had given me some jive about how they were going to change things.
But it took a while for it to sort of filter through and start to really impact the price of the bonds. So then 2014 comes along, and Puerto Rico decides to sell more bonds. But this time they got a lower rating, which means they weren't considered quite as safe or secure. And at that point, the analysts knew. You know, things are much worse than they had been. So you get to 2015, and it was becoming increasingly clear that Puerto Rico was in real financial trouble. So Governor Padilla, he makes a decision. He decides he's got to go to New York and face his Wall Street creditors. So he comes in late June, and he does an interview with the New York Times saying, for the first time, conceding that Puerto Rico will not be able to pay back its debt. And then the next day, Padilla gave a televised address to Puerto Ricans,
la deuda pública,
announcing
el nivel
that
de
we don't have the money to pay this back.
Es impagable.
He says, this is not politics. This is math.
Esto no se trata de política. Esto se trata de matemática.
Back on the island, Elias Gutierrez, the Puerto Rican economist we were talking with before, like many people in the Commonwealth, he was listening to that announcement.
I was listening to it. I think it was being broadcasted by radio or by, I think, in my computer. I couldn't believe what I was hearing.
And one of the reasons Elias was paying such close attention was because, if you remember, he owned a lot of Puerto Rican bonds.
The bond insurers who are exposed to Puerto Rico really tumbled yesterday, 20+% in some cases. And the bonds tied to Puerto Rican debt that's publicly traded have also really tumbled in terms of their face value.
And in the years after the governor's announcement, the value of those bonds fell and fell and fell.
And today, Puerto Rico bonds are trading even down even more and significantly so.
And in the end, Elias had to sell much of his investment for just a few cents on the dollar.
We sold them for pennies. 10 cents, 15 cents.
Now, remember, he's in his mid-70s, and he still has to work to get by. He wouldn't tell us exactly how much he lost, but he does say he now can't retire, and he doesn't know when he'll be able to retire.
Part of my retirement was planned on the interest flows of that capital.
You know, when I asked him about it, he said, it's, you know, I just didn't ever think it could get this bad. And he also said what a lot of the Puerto Rican bondholders we talked to are all, they're middle class Puerto Ricans, many of whom were using this for their retirement savings. They just said, you know, I just can't believe that the government would sell me something that they couldn't pay back.
It's a psychological blow too, you know. It's like when you break a glass and then it falls and it breaks in millions of little pieces. That's what happened with our credibility. And it will take decades to mend, no matter what we do.
Coming up on Latino USA, Puerto Rico attempts to put the pieces back together. Stay with us, no te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Fifth Generation Inc., maker of 80-proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, distilled from corn and naturally gluten-free. Recipes and more at titosvodka.com. Distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas. And FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, in a collaboration with WNYC in New York, we're looking at Puerto Rico's debt crisis. And when we left off, financial reporter Jane Sassine was taking us through the series of events that led Puerto Rico's governor to announce that the territory could not pay back its debt. And we're going to go back to Jane, who's going to pick up the story now.
So Puerto Rico says in 2015 that it can't pay its debt back. So all these bondholders and banks and also the hedge funds by now had started to buy in. And they're coming, kind of knocking on the door and saying, you have to pay me back. And then to make matters worse, Puerto Rico had no way to declare bankruptcy. So it has $72 billion in bond debt that it owes and no way out.
Okay, Jane, so just take a step back and define, when we say bankruptcy, What does that mean?
Bankruptcy is essentially a kind of protection. It's when you have more debt than you can pay. And so you go to the court and declare, I'm bankrupt, I can't pay this debt. And what the court then does is there's a kind of litigated process by which you then, whether you're an individual or a company or a city, you say, here's everything I have. Here are all my assets. So then the court basically looks at what you say you have and what you owe, and then the people you owe it to, who are called your creditors. And the court helps decide which creditors get paid, how much, and when. And the creditors, well, they'll never get everything back, but they're all fighting to try and get back as much as they can. The more different creditors you have, and the more assets you have, and the more different claims you have on those assets, the more complicated the whole thing is. And that sums up Puerto Rico in a nutshell.
All right, so why exactly can't Puerto Rico declare bankruptcy?
So states aren't allowed to declare bankruptcy, but cities or counties or other public entities can. And unlike other places in the U.S., Puerto Rico didn't have that option because when Congress rewrote the bankruptcy laws back in the 80s, it inexplicably left Puerto Rico out. No one knows why. But that meant it had no way to actually declare bankruptcy. So then Puerto Rico actually tried to pass its own law to allow itself, you know, under the territory's law to declare bankruptcy. But Wall Street kind of said, wait a minute, no, you can't do that. That's the conditions under which we bought this debt have changed. So they sued, and the whole thing ended up going all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And then the U.S. Supreme Court basically said, nope, sorry, Puerto Rico, you're a territory. You can't create your own bankruptcy law. So they weren't able to declare bankruptcy. So the responsibility then went to Congress. So Congress had to create a law that would allow them essentially to go bankrupt. And that's how we ended up with this law called PROMESA.
I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world.
Juan, before we move on with the rest of the show, there is a major vote on Puerto Rico in the U.S. Senate today.
Yes, there is. The Senate looks like will finally vote on what to do on the so-called PROMESA bill. This is the bill which would establish a means for Puerto Rico to restructure its $72 billion in debt.
Puerto Rico's government owes $118 billion in bonds and in unfunded pension liabilities. It has already defaulted on much of it.
Mr. Speaker, I rise in opposition to this legislation. The people of the Enchanted Island deserve better.
The Puerto Rican people are our fellow Americans. They pay our taxes. They fight in our wars.
President Obama signed PROMESA into law in 2016.
People of Puerto Rico need to know that they're not forgotten, that they're part of the American family, and Congress's responsiveness to this issue, even though this is not a perfect bill, at least moves us in the right direction.
So PROMESA did two things. One is it created a financial oversight board, which we'll talk a little more about later. And the other is it created a path for Puerto Rico to have kind of bankruptcy and to seek relief from its creditors. And one of the things I think that is people don't understand very well, and again, this is why it's so complex, is it's not just one bankruptcy. There are five separate bankruptcies. Before Puerto Rico, I think the biggest public bankruptcy in the United States was Detroit, which was at about $18 billion. And even that was huge compared to previous bankruptcies. But Puerto Rico is $72 billion in debt, and there are five separate bankruptcy cases. The Commonwealth itself declared essentially bankruptcy. The PREPA, the very troubled power company we've all heard a lot about, the Highway Authority, and there are two others, I think it's the Employees Retirement System, and I honestly can't remember what the fifth is. But so, and each of those is kind of almost the size of Detroit and of the complexity of Detroit alone. But there's five of them, and they're interlinked.
All right, so you've been reporting about the bankruptcy hearings. So what do they look like? Like, just describe them for us.
Yeah, so many of the hearings take place in Lower Manhattan. It's a kind of ornate, old-fashioned kind of courtroom. You know, there are rows and rows of chairs for the lawyers. It's all wood paneled and symbols of the judiciary everywhere. And there's so many lawyers. I don't know, there's like 80 to 100 lawyers sitting in this courtroom. And they're representing the hedge funds and the investment banks, all the other different creditors and the different agencies in Puerto Rico. And the person whose job it is to make order out of all of this is Judge Laura Taylor Swain. Judge Swain, she's a 59-year-old African-American woman from Brooklyn. And I wanted to learn more about her because she's arguably the most powerful person in this whole process. She was a bankruptcy judge in the early part of her career, and then she became a district court judge. And she's handled a lot of really complex financial cases over the last 10 years. She oversaw one of the trials of some of the people involved with the Bernie Madoff case. She was personally appointed by Chief Justice Roberts of the Supreme Court to oversee the Puerto Rican bankruptcy. And Kate Long, the bond analyst we spoke to earlier, told me Judge Swain was an obvious choice for the job.
She's very, very knowledgeable there. She has this really deep knowledge, I think, of the bankruptcy process. I think Chief Justice Roberts wanted the best legal mind from the federal bench that he could find.
So she's been holding hearings for about the last year. And basically what happens is all these lawyers come into a court and they argue sometimes for hours trying to get the best deal for their clients. For example, one of the cases on her docket could decide the fate of almost half of Puerto Rico's debt. It's about $35 billion worth, and it's owned by the two largest groups of creditors. And they're currently in negotiations outside of court, and they're trying to come to a negotiated deal, but if they can't come to agreement, it will fall to her to decide who that money really belongs to. When we were in Puerto Rico reporting this story, I spoke to a lot of people there and got a sense that Judge Swain is generally well-liked on the island. Many people believe she's going to give them a fair hearing. And also, she begins each proceeding, particularly in the months after the hurricane, with a greeting, a reminder to the people of Puerto Rico, you know, we hope things are getting better. I think it's very real and very heartfelt, but I also think it's her way of reminding, you know, these very high-priced Manhattan lawyers who are battling over fantastical sums of money, that there is this very human thing going on the other side of this, and we shouldn't forget this. And I think she never forgets that. And, you know, I think is pushing them to resolve some of the endless litigation that's costing a fortune so that this can be resolved in a way that allows Puerto Rico to kind of move forward and get this behind it. So the decisions that happen under Judge Swain, they're going to have a huge impact on Puerto Rico. They'll have a huge impact on people like Elias Gutierrez, the economist we talked to earlier who invested in Puerto Rican bonds. It will also affect the bottom line of the big banks and the hedge funds who bought up the island's debt. And it'll also affect the ordinary people who will most likely have to live under the new austerity measures that are being put through. There's another really important thing, too, and that's that the ability of Puerto Rico to rebound economically lies in the balance. You know, if investors lose faith that the island will repay its debts, then it's going to be nearly impossible for them in the future to get funding from the bond market, you know, for just basic government projects like building schools and building roads. So no matter what happens here, however Judge Swain rules on these things, lives are going to be affected.
Thank you so much, Jane, for all of your reporting on this story.
Thanks, Maria.
Jane Sassine is the director of the McGraw Center for Business Journalism at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. And we also recently collaborated with Jane on a multi-part series for WNYC. It's called Puerto Rico, The Future of Debt. And you can find it at WNYC.org. All right, so we were talking just now about PROMESA, which is the law passed by Congress in 2016. And one of the things that PROMESA did was to create a form of bankruptcy for Puerto Rico, as we talked about. The other main thing that it did was that it created the Financial Oversight and Management Board. Yeah, it's a mouthful. It's the 8-member oversight board that was created by Congress in 2016 to help keep a watchful eye on the island's debt. The board has say over Puerto Rico's finances and any future deal with creditors in the ongoing bankruptcy case. The board hasn't been popular on the island, in part because of the austerity measures that it's proposing, cuts to health care, to pensions, and to education. Latino USA's Andres Caballero visited Puerto Rico recently, and he met one young man who has made it his mission to fight back against the board.
It was a Friday afternoon at the University of Puerto Rico in San Juan, about 6 months after Hurricane Maria devastated the island. Gabriel Negron had just gotten back to his dorm, an old gray-looking 22-story building, also known as Torre Norte. The building offers subsidized housing for students who come from low-income families, like Gabriel. From his room, Gabriel started hearing some sort of commotion in the hallways. He followed the noise and went to see what was happening. Students were crying. Some held letters in their hands. So Gabriel opened his mailbox and started reading the letter signed by the dean,
which pretty much said that he was going to close down the building for next semester so they could remodel.
Gabriel said when the eviction notice arrived,
I cried in the privacy of the bathroom in my room.
Some of the students had only been sleeping on real beds for a few months since being left homeless by the hurricane, sleeping in shelters or relatives' couches. So the building closing meant they would have to start the search for housing all over again. Now, they only had a couple of months to move out, and they weren't given any other affordable options for the following semester.
So for me, it was either, if I don't get housing, I'm not going to be able to study.
Gabriel is 18. He stands at 6 feet, with blondish hair down to his shoulders. I met him on campus at the office of the General Student Council, which has a long tradition of activism and where he's the president. Gabriel taught himself English while watching TV, and now he's learning German. He's in his first year of majoring in economics, which today is a highly relevant topic to his life here in Puerto Rico.
This goes way back than Maria. Puerto Rico has been economically stagnating since 2005.
Puerto Rico is having a financial and economic crisis.
It's a little heavy-handed response now from this current bill.
It's not a humanitarian crisis, as he says.
I'm not going to deny the fact that Puerto Rico has an extraordinary number of challenges.
The recession has been official for 11 years now, more than half of Gabriel's life, which is partly what got him interested in economics. He was only 16 when the oversight board was created, and since then, he's been feeling the impact of its proposals on the island's economy.
Congress gave strong support to a relief plan that would create a federal oversight board.
Just days before Puerto Rico was expected to default.
Which will establish a federally appointed control board with sweeping powers to run Puerto Rico's economy.
And to say the least, the oversight board isn't very popular on the island.
The oversight board don't really have the best interests of Puerto Ricans in mind.
To Puerto Ricans, the board is known as La Junta. For people like Gabriel, who oppose the board, a big sticking point is the fact that the board is unelected. Puerto Ricans had no say in it. Its members are appointed directly by the U.S. president, with the exception of one who's appointed by Puerto Rico's governor. Many come from backgrounds in high finance positions, from places like Banco Popular or other large banks. Only half of them are Puerto Rican. Part of the Oversight Board's job is to make sure that Puerto Rico cuts its budget to help get on track and then pay back its creditors. The board is currently negotiating with the government on cuts to things like healthcare, pensions for retirees, and education.
They say that Puerto Rico needs to be guided into achieving fiscal responsibility, more economical growth, and that we need to tighten up our belts and implement austerity measures.
Which brings us back to the closing of Torre Norte, Gabriel's dorm. The university said it was closing the dorms for repairs, partially due to damage from the hurricane. But a lot of people believe it's an excuse for the university to start slashing costs. A month after Gabriel got the eviction notice, the Oversight Board and Puerto Rico's government announced its most recent proposal of cuts to Puerto Rico. Among those cuts is a reduction to the university's overall budget, cutting almost 20% of its personnel in the next 5 years and doubling the cost of tuition. Which is why on May Day, activists and students from across the island took to the streets of San Juan and marched toward the city's financial center. Gabriel was part of the protests.
Everything was pretty peaceful by that point. People were singing. People were wearing costumes, being dressed as rats, politicians. A lot of chanting and phrases against austerity measures, against the government, against the oversight board.
By the time they got to the financial district in San Juan, Gabriel found himself in front of five lines of heavily geared riot police. But even though he and the police were on different sides that day, he could relate to them more than most.
My mom is a cop, is a single mother.
Gabriel knew cops. He grew up around them. And now he was up against them.
On one side, I saw the fat cop who reminded me of one of my mother's friends. But on the other side, I saw the jacked up guy who was pretty intimidating and was looking at me with a very straight face.
Before getting out to the streets, Gabriel posted a comment on his Facebook explaining
that I was kind of like screwed up from all angles because on one side, I couldn't afford the increase on tuition cost. But on the other side, my mom isn't getting paid.
According to Gabriel, because of the recession, his mom isn't getting her overtime pay.
She worked day and night during Maria. She works 10 to 20 extra hours per month or even more. And just like hundreds and hundreds of cops, she's not getting her proper pay.
And like the university, the police are also facing cuts proposed by the board. Gabriel said he tried to talk to the officers to tell them that they were on the same side.
Hey, my mother's a cop. I know that they owe you the payment of the extra hours that you work. You don't have to do this.
When Gabriel looked at his phone, he saw a bunch of missed calls from his mom.
My mom is calling me multiple times saying, please get out of there. Something is going to happen. I'm very worried about you.
And she was right.
Police didn't move. Obviously, people started to like go through, and that's where the police started throwing pepper spray, gases, started hitting protesters, arresting people, hitting journalists.
Coming up on Latino USA, as Puerto Rico's financial crisis worsens, Gabriel faces a difficult choice: to stay in Puerto Rico and fight against the measures coming from the Oversight Board, or to leave the island and start from scratch.
I've been this close to say, to the hell of it and leave the island.
Stay with us, no te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the estate of Joan Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio, and Jane and Gerald Catcher, supporting the Children's Movement of Florida, dedicated to helping all children enter school with the social, emotional, and intellectual skills needed to succeed. More information is available at childrensmovementflorida.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And before we left off, Gabriel, an economics student at the University of Puerto Rico, found himself in the middle of tense May Day protests in San Juan. When the protests were over and the dust had settled, authorities in Puerto Rico were not happy. Here's Latino USA producer Andres Caballero once again.
After the May Day protests wound down, Governor Ricardo Rosselló condemned the violence and praised the police for putting themselves in harm's way to maintain order. Many protesters were hurt, several were arrested, and at least 15 police officers were injured. Some who watched the protests felt like the students were overreacting. After all, they seemed to have a pretty good deal. The University of Puerto Rico is the most prestigious on the island, and is pretty affordable compared to other public universities in the U.S. It's currently 70% funded by state and local government, compared to the 25% funding that public universities in the U.S. receive. Tuition is just $1,700 a year. But wages are also lower than on the mainland. For low-income students, doubling the cost of tuition could be a deterrent.
I'm afraid that I'm going to have to take less courses next semester and take even longer to graduate, get myself in debt.
Gabriel's mom was angry after the protest too, but for a different reason. She was upset with Gabriel about the comments he had posted on Facebook where he condemned police brutality.
She's like, why are you posting? Why are you being so anti-police this morning? Well, I have some convictions, mom, the same way you have yours. I respect your job, you're hardworking, but I believe that you're being used to oppress people that are fighting for their rights, and you're being a tool of people that don't want the best for us.
And then Gabriel says there was a shift that led them to understand each other a bit more. That even though they play opposite roles in the protests, as protester and cop, in the end, the crisis affects them both.
And now that she's feeling austerity cuts, she's now thinking, it's my job, but I support you, and I'm not going to be able to eat, but I'm going to provide for you and your sister if it has to be done after cuts to education.
For student activists like Gabriel, the key to fighting austerity is to fight the oversight board. After all, they can't just vote board members out if they don't like what they do.
People are so tired of colonial politics. People are so tired of the same politics that are still being imposed by Congress.
A week after the protest, on the other side of campus from Gabriel's dorm, students sat by a mural of Oscar Lopez Rivera, a legendary Puerto Rican freedom fighter, or terrorist, depending on who you ask. The mural read, quote, "We can have a better and more just world if we find the courage to fight for it." Close to that mural was the law school, where students had organized a symposium. They invited David Skeel, one of the oversight board members, to Skype in and take some questions. And he agreed. At last, this was the students' chance to speak directly to the board, maybe even influence its thinking. On the Facebook live stream, you can see Skeel's face appear on the giant screen, wearing round-frame glasses and a pair of headphones for the translation. A law student named Sol Vasquez stood up and addressed them.
The board wants to increase tuition, which affects students, many of which live at the poverty level. How do you plan to bridge that disconnect between the reality that you guys are observing from far away, from up there in Mount Olympus, and the reality that we have to live with the real life effects of what you're implementing?
And Skeel seemed receptive. At least he came off that way.
I think that's a very fair point. I personally have made efforts to get out into the community and to see the effect of the hurricanes.
Skeel is a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also written numerous books about debt, finance, bankruptcy. Before being appointed to the board, he didn't have much of a relationship with Puerto Rico.
On the struggles of lower-income students, we are aware of that. And
Skeel said that the hike the board is calling for is designed not to affect lower-income students like Gabriel. But students say that's not true. About 2 weeks after the protests, Gabriel and other students showed up to a student-faculty meeting demanding answers around the closure of Torre Norte, the subsidized dorm where Gabriel lives. Students held signs that read, quote, "My university is leaving me homeless." There were about 100 people in the room, faculty members, student senators, and the university's chancellor, Luis Ferrao. He sat on a table at the front of the room as he tried his best to answer questions coming from the students.
¿Por qué el proceso se da específicamente en este momento?
That's the chancellor. He says a big part of the closure has to do with damages caused by the hurricane. The students laughed in response. They didn't buy it. After all, the building had already reopened for months after the hurricane.
They're pretty much closing down the building so they don't have to give it maintenance, and that way they can take it out of the budget. Or they're paving a way for a privatization of the building.
Chancellor Ferrao told the students and faculty that the closure has nothing to do with privatization. One professor got up and asked why students weren't given any other housing options. After the meeting, I asked Chancellor Ferrao if they were going to provide alternatives for these students.
The fiscal board is controlling or limiting our university's budget. That's a fact. We don't have the amount of money that would take to relocate all the students.
On June 15th, the day the students were supposed to vacate the building, Gabriel went up to his room in Torre Norte and packed up his stuff. Some of the students tried camping outside, so the university sent security guards to make sure they left the building peacefully. Gabriel finished packing and walked right out. He said all he felt was numb. Recently, the university announced it would give stipends to help some of the affected students pay for private housing next semester. Gabriel says he found out about it too late and missed the deadline. The thing about all this is that the University of Puerto Rico has always represented a way out of poverty for low-income students, a path to the impossible. So you have Gabriel here, who embodies that Puerto Rican student success story. Child of a single mother, someone who managed to get accepted into a prestigious program. But even after doing his part and making good headway during his first year, he's still hitting a wall.
I've been this close to say, to the hell of it and leave the island.
Gabriel says that even though he and his friends are desperately looking for reasons to stay and make things work, it seems like they're constantly reminded of all the reasons there are to leave.
Like, you know, it's easy to say I'm going to stay here, but once you get the chance to start all over, it's a decision that it's hard to take and that many people just decide to leave.
He says that after Hurricane Maria, many of his friends left to places like Florida, New York, Texas. But when the fiscal plan goes into effect,
it's going to be a breaking point for people. It might be a breaking point for me even.
Gabriel says he's constantly struggling between staying positive and his own anxiety about what comes next.
Even as you try to run from thinking about it, at the end of the day, when you're in bed and you're consulting with your pillow, you're going to think about this and it's going to give you anxiety. Sometimes it feels that it's beyond your control and we're making the efforts in preparing ourselves. We're preparing for the worst.
Ultimately, Gabriel's reality, one of feeling like you're constantly trying to get up only to be knocked down again. And again, with the loss of subsidized housing, a tuition increase, cuts to healthcare. In a way, this also reflects a much larger reality of Puerto Rico as a whole, an island trying to recover from an 11-year recession, the destruction left by Hurricane Maria, a bankruptcy filing, and now budget cuts, ones that could easily push more people to have to make that difficult choice, whether to stay or to go.
Our thanks to Andres Caballero for reporting that story. The board is still in negotiations with the Puerto Rican government, and it plans to approve budgets for the Commonwealth and for the University of Puerto Rico by June 29th. In the meantime, some activists in Puerto Rico and the diaspora have been advocating for the debt to be wiped clean, arguing it's necessary for a just recovery for the island. What will most likely happen, though, is that everybody will get a haircut, as they say in the world of finance. That means everybody takes a loss.
How do you get all the creditors and all the recipients of public services to agree on haircuts?
That's the challenge, says Dick Ravitch. He's the public bankruptcy guru we heard from at the beginning of the episode, who helped rescue New York City and Detroit back in the day. Ravitch says Puerto Rico has a bigger challenge ahead of it than those two cities in the past, because it's not clear how they're going to realistically bring in enough money to pay off the debt.
In Puerto Rico, nobody knows where the revenues are going to be, and that was compounded by the tragedy of the hurricane, where they've lost a great population. The power grid, which was in terrible shape even before the hurricane, is still breaking down every other week. So nobody can be sure what the revenues are going to be.
And so he says Puerto Rico is going to need some help.
So I would think that the United States government ought to rebuild that grid. After all, those 3.5 million people down there are citizens. They served in our armed forces and they died for the United States. And I think they're entitled to a hell of a lot more than what they're getting.
The government has to make cuts. There is next to zero chance that Washington is going to wave its hand and make the debt go away. And that's a hard thing to swallow. No matter what happens, it's going to be a long, long road ahead for the recovery of Puerto Rico's economy. That's it for today. Our episode was a collaboration with WNYC in New York. You can check out their series, Puerto Rico, The Future of Debt, at WNYC.org. Latino USA is produced by Miguel Macias, Antonia Cerejido, Andres Caballero, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoca, and Sayer Quevedo. Production help this week from Vera Carruthers. We're edited by Marlon Bishop and Sofia Paliza Carr. Our engineers and music editors are Ginny Montalvo and Stephanie LeBeau. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelhotz. Our fellows are Maya Cueva and Jesse Alejandro Cottrell. Fact-checking this week by Jennifer Velez. Special thanks to Jane Sassine, Patricia Willens, Zeke Peña, Jacqueline Sincada, Luis Valentin Ortiz, and the folks at the Centro de Periodismo Investigativo in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos, and if you liked the music you heard on this episode, be sure to stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us for our next episode, and in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media, and I'll see you there. Ciao!
This episode is made possible by the Charles H. Revson Foundation. The statements made and views expressed, however, are solely the responsibility of the author, and the Jacob and Valeria Langloth Foundation, the Park Foundation, WNET's Chasing the Dream Initiative, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Here we go.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Annenberg Foundation, committed to supporting, educating, and engaging communities in the United States and globally for more than 25 years. Learn more at annenbergfoundation.org and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working alongside others to build a culture of health that provides everyone in America a fair and just opportunity for health and well-being. More at rwjf.org. This is NPR.